John Fitzgerald Kennedy, son of a prominent Boston family, war hero, senator, statesman, 35th President of the United States. May 29, 1917, November 22, 1963. The world knows of the tragedy that struck America. A sharp, cracking sound of a high-powered assassin's rifle told the tragic tale in echoing volleys. 3 days later, the volley thunder of precision military honor guards echoed their last tribute to John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Let us go back over those 72 hours, minute by minute. The shock, the grief, the stunning numbness. Let us go farther back to that early morning of November 22nd. President Kennedy awoke early in his Fort Worth motel. He was on his second day of what was already being billed as a triumphant political stumping tour in Texas. San Antonio, Houston, Fort Worth. An exuberant President Kennedy briskly walked to a waiting limousine. He and Mrs. Kennedy were to attend a Fort Worth Chamber of Commerce breakfast. Thousands gathered to cheer the nation's chief executive and first lady. Mrs. Kennedy was wearing a pretty pink wool suit. President Kennedy wore a plain blue suit. That morning, there was a slight mist in the Texas sky, but otherwise, a comfortable day. Elsewhere around the nation, people were waking to sunny skies and warm weather. History was being made as the president gave what later would become his final public speech.
We would like to live as we once lived, but history will not permit it. The communist balance of power is still strong. The balance of power is still on the side of freedom. We are still the keystone and the arch of freedom, and I think we will continue to do as we have done in our past, our duty. I'm confident, as I look to the future, that our chances for security, our chances for peace, are better than they've been in the past. And the reason is because we're stronger. And with that strength is a determination to not only maintain the peace, but also the vital interests of the United States. To that great cause, Texas and the United States are committed. Thank you.
A busy schedule was plotted for the day. The next stop was Dallas, where the president was due to deliver a major speech at the Dallas Auditorium during the noon hour. He was slightly behind schedule, just a few minutes. His huge jet plane, Air Force One, landed at Dallas Airport shortly after 11 a.m. 5,000 people were on hand to greet the chief executive. Vice President Lyndon Johnson was there, as well as newsmen from the Washington Press Corps. As the smiling president stepped down from the silvery jet, a waiting, welcoming committee greeted Mr. Kennedy and gave Mrs. Kennedy a bouquet of red roses. Even though the president was a few minutes behind schedule, he stopped for a few moments to shake hands with some voters. At 11:50 a.m., the president finally climbed into the special bulletproof limousine, the top down. Texas Governor John Connally and Mrs. Connally sat in the black Lincoln special jump seats, the Kennedys directly behind them. Two Secret Service men in the front seat, one a driver, the other a guard. Downtown Dallas was roaring with an unexpected, joyous welcome. Thousands lined the streets near the intersection of Main, Elm, and Commerce Streets. Just past a small underpass, spectators waited, 10 and 20 deep. Dallas patrolmen and helmeted motorcycle officers kept the traffic and pedestrians in order. Soon, the president's convoy approached, first zooming motorcycles. From a distance just before the underpass, we could catch a glimpse of the president's shining limousine, the chief executive's flag on the left fender, the stars and stripes on the right. Then there was a Secret Service car, followed by Vice President and Mrs. Johnson, then more Secret Service men, then the cars and buses loaded with newsmen from around the world. It was 12:29 p.m. now, and within a single moment, at exactly 12:30 p.m. this Friday, November 22nd, 1963, the world's attention would be focused on that street corner just below the underpass. It was then that a thousand things happened. The screaming, panicked crowds, the screeching, speeding sirens told the puzzled onlookers that what they saw was true. The President of the United States had just been shot. While the world will remember that tragic event forever, some eyewitnesses shall bear the brunt of seeing a horrible, nightmarish true fact.
He was coming down the street, and my five-year-old boy and myself were by ourselves on the grass there on Commerce Street, and I asked Joe to wave to him, and Joe waved, and I waved, and the man, as he was waving back, he was the shot rang out, and he slumped down in the seat, and his wife reached up toward him, and as he was slumping down, and the second shot went off, and it just knocked him down from the seat.
Two shots.
Went.
Did you see the man who did this?
No, sir, I did not see the man who did it. All I did was look in the man's face when he was shot there and saw that expression on his face and grab himself and slide. And the second one, whenever it went, why, I'm positive it had hit him. I hope it didn't, but I'm positive that it hit him, and he went all the way down in the car. Then they speeded up, and I didn't know what was going on, so I just grabbed the boy and fell on him in hopes that there wasn't a maniac around me. I'm sorry. I can't help you more, but I won't forget.
The President was shot twice, but there had been still another shot fired. It struck Governor Connally. The wives of both men cuddled their husbands in their laps, and the blood-spattered limousine, which had left the parade convoy, began to zigzag through the streets at a speed of 70 miles an hour. Destination, Parkland Memorial Hospital. At the now infamous underpass, men and women were running, some dropping to the ground, others falling on their children for protection against any possible further shootings. Policemen began scurrying about, their pistols drawn. Secret Service agents had their submachine guns drawn, their eyes glaring up and down the streets, peering into doorways, glancing at windows of nearby buildings. One man screamed out, "I just saw a gun pointing out a window of the nearby Texas warehouse." Other witnesses who saw the horror before their own eyes began to piece the details together.
Moved into the street just as the President's car came by, and actually we were almost touching the car. The President was on the right, Jackie was on the left, in the back seat. And they were smiling and waving to the crowd. And they passed us very quickly. The car was moving quite quickly. And just as they got about a half a block from where we were standing, the shots rang out. The President seemed to stand up at first and fall backwards, and then fell to the left right into Jackie's arms. As we were just milling around there, there was just mass confusion. I think that possibly that they did know right then, because of the sounds were quite vivid, the shooting sounds. And then the complete breakup of the parade indicated that everyone seemed to be aware that something drastic had happened.
Something drastic had happened. 12:32 p.m. Police began scouring the school building. They found nothing on the first five floors. Then, midway between the fifth and sixth floors of that huge warehouse, behind several crates of textbooks, a policeman found a foreign-made 6.5-millimeter rifle, a high-powered telescopic lens attached. More troopers rushed up to the sixth floor. There, discovered near an open window, were three empty rifle shells, the scraps of a chicken dinner, and an empty soda bottle. ...12:35 p.m. The President's limousine was just pulling into the hospital emergency driveway. Doctors were standing ready with nurses and attendants. They had already been notified that someone had been shot in the presidential convoy. It wasn't until they saw Mrs. Kennedy holding on to the President's limp body that they realized an international tragedy had just occurred. At that very moment, a frightened little boy was telling police he saw a man running from the building just moments before. 12:36 p.m. Police issue a radio call for an all-points pickup. white male, about 30 years old, 160 to 165 pounds. At least one Dallas police officer apparently got that bulletin. His name was Patrolman J.D. Tippett, 38 years old. 12:45 p.m., two Roman Catholic priests entered the hospital. Fears mounted among the newsmen. Hospital people and spectators gathered outside the building. The next announcement came at a few minutes after 1 o'clock. It was the announcement that stopped a nation in its tracks. The world became stunned and grief-stricken. In a barely audible voice, a press secretary read the following words. President John F. Kennedy died at approximately 1 p.m. Central Standard Time here in Dallas. He died of a gunshot wound in the brain. I have no further details of the assassination. From around the nation and the world came the tributes to the 35th President of the United States. Adlai Stevenson, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. Now President Lyndon Johnson. Former President Dwight D. Eisenhower. Great Britain's Alec Hume. Pope Paul. GOP presidential hopefuls Nelson Rockefeller and Barry Goldwater.
Tragedy of this day is beyond instant comprehension. All of us who knew him will bear the grief of his death to the day of ours. And all men everywhere who love peace and justice and freedom will bow their heads. At such a moment, we can only turn to prayer. Prayer to comfort our grief, to sustain Mrs. Kennedy and his family, to strengthen President Johnson, and to guide us in time to come. May God help us.
This is a sad time for all people. We have suffered a loss that cannot be weighed. For me, it is a deep personal tragedy.
I share the sense of shock and dismay that the entire nation must feel at the despicable act that took the life of the nation's president. On the personal side, Mrs. Eisenhower and I share the grief Mrs. Kennedy must now feel, and we send to her our prayerful thoughts and sympathetic sentiments at this in this hour. In the face of such a terrible thing, I'm sure the entire citizenry, the nation, will join as one man in expressing their, not only their grief, but their indignation at this act, and will stand faithfully behind the government. The American nation is a people of great common sense, and they are not going to be stampeded or bewildered.
This moment is the more poignant because only a few weeks ago I was walking with President Kennedy in the grounds of the White House, and he was telling me of his plans to guard and to keep the peace of the world. And as I recall his vivid presence, he lives in my mind as a man who, first of all, was a man of peace and a man with a deep religious faith, which was dedicated to healing the divisions between men. In 3 short years of his presidency, he left an indelible mark on his country and on the world. And for us in Britain, his loss is a deep and a sad one, because he was the most loyal and faithful of allies.
We are deeply shocked by this sad and tragic news of the killing of the president of the United States of America, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, and the serious wounding of Governor Connally. And we are profoundly saddened by so dastardly a crime, by the mourning which afflicts a great and civilized country in its head, by the suffering which strikes at Mrs. Kennedy, her children, and the family. With all our heart, we deplore this unhappy event. We express the heartfelt wish that the death of this great statesman may not damage the cause of the American people, but rather reinforce its moral and civil sentiments and strengthen its feelings of nobility and concord. And we pray to God that the sacrifice of John Kennedy may be made to favor the cause he promoted and to help defend the freedom of peoples and peace in the world. He was the first Catholic president of the United States. We recall our pleasure in receiving its visit and in having discerned in him great wisdom and high resolution for the good of humanity.
This was a shocking and terrible tragedy for the nation and the world. Mrs. Rothwell and I join with all New Yorkers and every American in extending heartfelt sympathy to Mrs. Kennedy and the President's family. May God grant strength and guidance to Lyndon Johnson as he assumes his grave responsibilities under these tragic circumstances. The prayers of all of us will be with him.
Well, I'm shocked, like the rest of the people are shocked. And how will it affect your plans, sir?
I don't think it'll affect my plans at all, or I don't want to discuss it.
Sir, have you had any chance to discuss this with anyone?
Nobody, nobody, and I don't care to discuss it.
The time is 1:13 p.m., and the Dallas police chief tells what happened during the next 22 minutes.
Some 30 minutes after the president was shot, one of our officers, Mr. J.D. Tippett, stopped this man on a street over in a section of town called Oak Cliff. This is about 2.5 miles from the location where the president was shot. We don't know why the officer stopped him, other than he must have suspected him of something, or maybe he was jaywalking or something of that kind. But the witnesses in the case of the officer saw this man shooting. We have witnesses on that. And he came over to the car, and the officer beckoned him over to the car, and he came over to the car and leaned through the window and talked to the officer a moment. Then the officer opened the door of the car and got out of the car and walked toward the front, and the man pulled a gun and shot him. He then fled on foot. A few minutes later, he entered a theater about 4 or 5 blocks from this location, and an usher became suspicious of him because of his apparent agitation and that he kept moving from seat to seat. And he called the police, and we went into this place and located him. And when the officer beckoned him out of the seat, he raised up in the seat, he struck the officer in the face and pulled a gun and attempted to fire at the gun, but the officer was grappling with him and the gun misfired. And after some difficulty, they overpowered him and got him out of the theater. And so the actual apprehension was some 5 or 6 blocks from where the shooting of the officer took place.
Police began to quiz the suspect. He was identified as Lee Harvey Oswald, a 24-year-old ex-Marine, born in New Orleans, raised in New York and Fort Worth. He quit high school when he was 17 years old and enlisted in the Marine Corps, but he received a hardship discharge before his time was up. He did, however, successfully qualify as a sharpshooter. Was Lee Oswald alone in the assassination of President Kennedy? This is a question that may never really be answered.
We don't believe there was anyone else in on the actual shooting. This man had some communistic beliefs and leanings and was pro-Castro in his thinking. And there may have been some other people aware of it. We don't know yet. We're still probing that aspect of it. There was another man that was taken into custody this morning for questioning who worked in this same building with him. This man is this man has been in our subversive files for some time, but whether or not he was connected with it, we don't know yet.
Oswald's past was being uncovered. He spent some time in Russia trying to obtain a citizenship there, but he was refused. He married a Russian girl who spoke little English. As the suspected assassin became caught in the web of evidence, police began to tighten their case against the man who was considered to be a loner.
It's progressing real fine. We still have a few witnesses to talk to. The FBI and the Secret Service and the State Police and the Sheriff's Department have all been cooperating in this effort, and we think we have a real strong case against this man. We filed charges last night around midnight, and he was arraigned before a justice of the peace shortly after filing charges. And the investigation is still progressing. There are some loose ends to pull together, but essentially we have a case built. There are a few employees that worked with him in this place that we need to talk to. The man still denies implication in it, but in spite of his denial, we still have witnesses that can put him there. We have a real strong case that we feel will stand up in court. There are a few people yet to talk to, but we have enough now that we had ample grounds upon which to file charges. And of course, this was discussed with the district attorney before charges were filed to be sure that we did have. And he feels that we have a good case.
2:38 p.m. Just 98 minutes after John Kennedy was officially declared dead, the cold, factual progress of government went into motion. Vice President Lyndon Baines Johnson was sworn in as the 36th President of the United States. The ceremony took place in the presidential jet, Air Force One. 27 people jammed the stuffy front compartment. In a rear compartment lay the gold-bronzed casket bearing the president's body. Tearfully, 67-year-old Federal District Judge Sarah T. Hughes began the official oath of office. Johnson's right hand raised, his left on a tiny Bible. Mrs. Johnson standing at his right side, the stunned Mrs. John Kennedy staring into space, standing immediately to the new president's left side.
I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
Within seconds, the huge jet began the long journey back to the nation's capital. During the next few hours, a nation trembling with grief echoed its cries. People at work, at home, on the street, damned the terrible deed and asked why.
What for? What for did they do it?
I don't know.
The only man that we had.
Oh, it's just terrible. I just can't believe it. No, I just can't say no more.
Oh, he's dead, and he was the best man that ever lived. A wonderful president. God rest his soul.
He was a good man for everybody, the raised pay and everything.
for the working men.
Who could have done it? Was the rat that done it?
Oh, I think it's terrible. I hope they get the guy. I hope they kill that guy. Oh, it's awful.
I hope they kill that guy. A tragic prophecy being planned at that very moment. It was near dusk as the huge presidential plane touched down at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland that Friday evening. President Johnson was the first to step from the plane. He was surrounded by newsmen, awaiting the chief executive's first public statement.
This is a sad time for all people. We have suffered a loss that cannot be weighed. For me, it is a deep personal tragedy. I know that the world shares the sorrow that Mrs. Kennedy and her family bear. I will do my best. That is all I can do. I ask for your help and God's.
As President Johnson began to carry the reins of government, arrangements for the president's funeral were being made. 12 o'clock, midnight. Lee Harvey Oswald was charged with the murder of President Kennedy. At that very hour, the president's body was being prepared for the last mile. It would be the final trip to the White House for the president that morning. A casket, caisson, and military honor guard stood by. During those long waiting hours of early Saturday morning, reminiscing became part of the time passing for most news reporters. They recalled a meeting between then-Senator John F. Kennedy and famed writer Stephen LaRon.
Well, it was in 1960, late spring, that I visited Senator Kennedy in his office in Washington. And we had a little lunch, and I was joking with him, and I said to him, I wish you wouldn't run for the nomination. And he said, why? I said, you know what happened in the past, ever since 1840, every president who was elected in 20 years intervals died in the presidential chair or was assassinated. So the next one, next president, who's supposed to die, will be the one who is elected in 1960. And he laughed and he said, well, I tell you what, you know, if I get the nomination, if I get elected, I will promise you to break the jinx. And we laughed about it, and that was the whole thing.
That was not the whole thing. The missing link was the date, November 22nd, 1963. All that Saturday, the nation's leaders sped to Washington to pay tribute to the nation's number one American. The nation's people watched the events on television and heard the vivid, detailed descriptions on radio. On Sunday, the president's body lay in state beneath the great Capitol Rotunda. The casket was draped in a flag and was surrounded by a five-service military honor guard. The casket was never to be opened. The president had been disfigured by the assassin's bullets. In Dallas, it was 7 minutes past the noon hour. Lee Harvey Oswald, until now, had steadfastly and defiantly denied any guilt in the murder. A huge throng of reporters and TV cameras gathered around the police headquarters. Oswald was being transferred to the Dallas County Jail. Manacled and guarded by police detectives holding his arms, Oswald was led to a waiting armored car. Oswald had just a few feet to go as the nation watched the dramatic action live on TV. Police allowed only newsmen near the alleged killer, But suddenly, a man dressed in a dark overcoat and a gray felt hat leaped over a rope barrier, pushed his way through the reporters, ran face to face with Oswald, and pulled out a revolver.
He's been shot. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot. There's the man with a gun. Absolute panic. Absolute panic here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. Detectives have their guns drawn. Oswald has been shot. There is no question about it. Oswald has been shot. Pandemonium has broken loose here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. I was standing over towards the left. Oswald came out. He had the same look on his face that he always does or has. What sounded like a loud firecracker rang out. He grabbed his side and he said, "Ow!" and fell to the ground.
Fell to the ground. And I saw the flash right on his black sweater. The flash. Oh yeah. The man is had a hat. A dark hat, a brown suit, he was stocky and strong, came to him and he put the gun right there. I saw the flash over the black sweater. Yeah, and the man stood like... Oh, he was right here. The man was right here. You probably had it on your TV camera. No, I saw a man there. I thought he was one of the detectives.
Well,
he was a stocky guy, well-dressed, with a hat he had on.
Where did he go?
Brown hat up. I don't know. I think his coat was brown and his hat was
where
black.
Where did he go, Pierre?
Well, he was here. They just put the gun there. I saw the flash on the black sweater. Oh, yeah, right there. And the guy... Right here. I mean, I saw the flash on the black sweater. You know, that's what I remember.
At 1:07 p.m., despite frantic efforts by doctors at the same hospital President Kennedy was rushed to, Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin, died. Now the world might never learn what truly went wrong in the mind of the president's killer. By this time, back at Dallas Police Headquarters, detectives had already arrested their man. He was Jack Ruby, real name Jacob Rubenstein, a well-known Dallas nightclub owner. He was officially charged with the murder. Monday morning, the final day of events began to unfold. It was the day of the funeral for President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Hundreds upon hundreds of foreign dignitaries, premiers, presidents, potentates, and politicians from around the world gathered to pay their last respects to our fallen chief. It was 10:55 a.m. A bright sun sprayed its beam on the center of the Capitol Rotunda. Outside, a million persons lined the streets to say farewell to JFK. 9 servicemen from all branches slowly carried the flag-draped casket from the Capitol, down the 36 steps, onto the street, and atop the horse-drawn artillery caisson. Slowly, the funeral procession began the nearly 2-mile distance to the White House, then on to St. Matthew's Cathedral. Throughout, the military drums beat their song of sorrow. It was at the cathedral that Richard Cardinal Cushing of Boston led the sad, solemn mass. It was he that eulogized the president as a leader of America and a friend.
A shocked and stricken world stands helpless before the fact of death. That death brought to us through a tragically successful assault upon the life of the President of the United States. Our earliest disbelief has slowly given way to unprecedented sorrow as millions all over the earth join us in lamenting a silence that can never again be broken, and the absence of a smile that can never again be seen. For those of us who knew the President as friend as well as statesman, words mock our attempt to express the anguish of our hearts. It was my privilege to have been associated with John F. Kennedy from the earliest days of his public life and even prior to that time. My privilege to have watched him mature with ever expanding responsibility. To have known some of the warmth of his hearty friendship. To see tested under pain and loss the steely strength of his character. I have been with him in joy and in sorrow, in decision and in crisis, among friends and with strangers. And I know of no one who has combined in more noble perfection the qualities of greatness that marked his calm, cool, calculating intelligence and his big, brave, bountiful heart. Now, all of a sudden, he has been taken from us, and I dare say we shall never see his like again.
Then came the last 3 miles from the church to Arlington National Cemetery. Again, the drums beat their death march. 10,000 persons gathered at the final resting place for the president, and again Cardinal Cushing delivered the final prayers. When he finished, a massive 21-gun artillery salute volleyed in the air. 50 jet planes zoomed overhead in the sky. The massive sounds were joined by Air Force bagpipes, loved so dearly by the president. Then came the silence and the sounding of taps. The flag that draped the president's casket was carefully folded and handed to Mrs. Kennedy. She then struck the blue-flamed eternal light over her husband's grave and placed a small bouquet of lilies at her feet. As Americans around the nation did, Mrs. John F. Kennedy prayed, wept, and went away lonely.